Hello, I'm Ian Danter. This is The Commentator's Curse. This is the programme where I get friends of mine involved from the commentary boxes that I've been in up and down the years, because I've been commentating on football for local and national radio for over 20 years now. And whoever I meet in a press box, they do the same job as me, but an entirely different job in some ways, and an entirely different route as to how they got there, because everybody's got their own story to tell. And that's what this podcast is all about, in a way, lifting the lid on this balmy, strange old world that us commentators inhabit. There's an archive of episodes that you can check out from episode one that we did a few weeks back with Ian Crocker and Guy Mowbray, up to the most recent episode that I recorded before this one with Sam Matterface and Daniel Mann. You'll get that wherever you get your podcasts. You can rate, review and subscribe and all that malarkey and spread the word. That would be very kind of you. Let's get on with this edition of The Commentator's Curse and welcome my two guests. My first guest is a rarity, actually, in radio, in that he's been able to straddle the two worlds of BBC Radio 5 Live and Talk Sport as a commentator. I don't think there's many on that list who can say that they have worked for both national radio broadcasters as a football commentator. He's with Talk Sport now. He's been England correspondent, but he also works for many other organisations besides. It's Nigel Adley with us on The Commentator's Curse. Hello, Nigel.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Very, very good, sir. Thank you for coming on. And, well, I had to get the other guest on, otherwise legal action would have ensued, because I've talked about him in pretty much every episode I've done so far, because, frankly, he's the reason I'm here. He never lets me forget it. He won't let me forget it during the course of this hour. He is the doyen of Midland Sports Radio. He was the sports editor at BRNB and Capital Gold in Birmingham for many, many years and spearheaded the huge leaps and bounds that BRNB and Capital Gold made in the 90s in particular, in terms of dominating the football horizon for listeners around the second city. And he works for TalkSport now, doing occasional updates and reports and does press conferences for us. It's my old boss, Tom Ross. How are you, Tom?
Dance, I'm good, thank you. I'm very good. And I see you've blamed me already for you. Thank you.
I'll take the blame. Well, listen, I've blamed you in the past six episodes. I might as well keep it consistent and blame you today. As everybody has a different route. And the thing that you have, Tom, of course, you've worn a number of different hats. You started as a reporter. You've become, you know, a second in command. You've then become the sports editor. You were a summariser. You then became a commentator. You've run the whole gamut.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what makes you better at anything you do in life. That makes you better when you've done everything you can do in the build-up. You know, I've had a fantastic career in radio and still going on, small beat, but I'm still going on. And I absolutely love the past, talking about how we got into it, because I was a late developer, Dance. A bit like yourself, really. You know, you came in after being in the guitar world. There are people who've been in radio all their lives. And I'm celebrating next January, my 45th year in radio, which is a long time. But before that, I had proper jobs, you know. I had to earn a living and proper jobs and got into it that way. But I've had all those roles in radio and, you know, ended up being head of sport of the five stations, you know, that Orion ran after they were sold by Capital to Orion, to Phil Riley and David Lloyd.
Well, we will get to all of that history as we go on during the course of this chat. Nigel, I don't actually know how you got into radio and where you started, because people may or may not know you're a Tranmere fan. Were you a Merseyside native at all during your youth? Because I know you live just outside London now.
Well, I was brought up in Chester, but my dad's from the Wirral, which is why I support Tranmere. But unlike you guys, I never had a proper job. I went straight into working in radio pretty much from university. When I was at university, I was fortunate to meet a guy called Alistair Yeomans, who we both know. Yeah. He was the sports editor at BBC Radio York at the time. And I used to go in on a Saturday afternoon and help out. And it sort of came from there. Because as we all know, in local radio, there's not a huge budget. So if you show any aptitude for doing anything, you tend to do it on a more regular basis. And I started reporting on games. I started doing sports bulletins, and eventually when I left university, they gave me a job as somebody who got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and used to take the circuits. They used to call these things the circuits, and basically it was the same in independent radio as well, there would be a central hub in London that would send out reports and interviews, news and sport, to all of the local stations. And it was my job first thing in the morning to take all these tapes in and organise them for the breakfast show. And that's how I got in sort of as a full-time job. And then eventually I applied for various roles, got a job as a sports reporter at BBC Radio Lancashire, which is where I first came across Tom when he was covering Villa in Birmingham, and sort of moved on from there.
I was doing the PA announcing at Birmingham City. And that's how I got my start, because somebody said, the guy at Hospital Radio, BHBN, wants to know if you want to do something there. And I went there, and it was from there that Tim Russon, who was head of sport at BBC Radio, not WM it was then, it was Radio Birmingham, said, would I cover Blues games for them? So I went to the BBC first, and just on a freelance basis, covered Birmingham games home and away. That's what I did. And then I got a call one day from Butler saying, meet me at the D Club, my boy. And within an hour, I'd got a job, and I was at Stoke the next day. It's quite strange, really.
This is Tony Butler, who we'll get to in a bit, who was the original loudmouth phoning host anywhere in the UK, something he'd inherited from the States. I just wanted to ask you, Nigel, you know, you mentioned that you went to university. Was broadcasting in your mind when you went to university first, or did the opportunity of meeting Alistair suddenly formulate it in your mind?
No, it's what I always wanted to do. I was one of the sad kids who used to record commentaries into cassette players and listen back, and you'd watch games on the television. And of course, we're all of the era where there wasn't a huge amount of live football on television when we were growing up. And it's what I always wanted to do. I actually did a politics degree at university, because in those days, you didn't really have to take a vocational degree. Nowadays, you'd look to take a sports journalism degree or something similar and work your way in that way. I just did a degree because I didn't know what else I wanted to do, really, in terms of, or didn't know how to get into the business. And I was very fortunate to sort of get in at the bottom level. And I think that is, in many ways, the best way to do it, because I think you learn on the job, you make your mistakes, you learn from your mistakes, and hopefully you don't repeat them. And I think the wealth of experience I got at a very young age was very important to me, and it's still important to me now.
It's incredible, isn't it? I realised in my youth that the BBC would tend to only take people on who had done degree courses. They weren't particularly interested in anybody who wasn't an undergraduate, which, you know, cut me out of the loop, because I had never had any intention of going to university, and I guess nor did you, Tom.
From the back street slums of Aston and Birmingham, not a chance going to get to work, mate. I didn't leave school till 17, but university was never on my radar. But I was, you know, I listened to the BBC stuff. I was a sports report, you know, Saturday evening. That was and listening to Glenn Denning and Eamon Andrews and David Coleman and all these other wonderful, Brian Jones, all these great reports. And that's what I always wanted, to be one of them. You know, even before I got into, I never thought I'd get into radio, but those were the people that impressed and inspired me to think I could have a go at it if I get the chance.
So wait a minute, if you were working as a sales manager for an electrical...
National sales, no. National sales manager at a company called Dun & Bradstreet, which do books, accounts and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I was based in the City of London, and I took a 66% drop in wages to get into radio.
Well, how did you get the opportunity at St Andrews, first of all, to do the tannoy announcing that led to the radio work?
Thanks to Trevor Francis, really. Trevor said to Jeff Greaves, the commercial manager, because me and Trevor and I had met through, I'd been at a game through a sponsor, and he was the man of the match, and we were talking music. So I was going to his house and we were swapping albums. And by the way, my John Ottaway and Wild Billy Barrett album, he hasn't given me back yet. And that was 40 years ago, but that's another story. So, and he said to Jeff Greaves, I've got this guy who'll do play the music on Saturday and do it. And Jeff Greaves rang me and said, would you like to do it? And I said, oh, yeah, not much. Free, of course, which in them days everything was. But it was a way to get in behind a microphone, which was fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I did too. I did the PA announcing
for
a year and a bit. And Trevor was the manager by that time. And there was this extraordinary day where for years, you won't know this nice necessarily, but the Blues used to run out to a version of Keep Right On done by the Rocking Berries, which sort of had every sound effect you get on a kid's keyboard.
Which I recorded with them, by the way, so be careful.
Whistles and bells and everything. But Trevor came into the commentary booth, which was over the tunnel on the halfway line at St. Andrews one Saturday, so I was sat there, and he just said, play this at 2:55, and handed me a copy of Feel It by the Tamperer, which was a song that was based on Can You Feel It by the Jacksons and been given a dance remix in the late 90s. So his son evidently had bought the single and given it to Trevor. James, I think it was. His son gave it to me, and I played it as directed, and the crowd started clapping in time with the music.
How big did that catch on, dance?
Amazing. It did catch on. I had to end up doing an edit, so you actually extended the intro so people had could clap longer and longer with the intro. But yeah, that wasn't paid either. But when you started as a Saturday lad, Nigel, up in was it York you worked with Alistair Yeomans first, and then you moved across to Lancashire?
Yeah, I was at Radio York. I used to get a fiver for going in and sorting out the non-league scores, ringing around the rugby union grounds, because, of course, it was all different to what people experience now. There was no internet, so everything was done on the phone. And the guys would be reporting on York City and Scarborough in the lower reaches of the Football League. And I used to travel across every weekend during my holidays. You know, I would sort of, I'd probably massively out of pocket, because I'd get the train from Chester, where I lived, over to York and then back again on the Saturday. But I thought it was important to do it. It was important to try and get a couple of toes in the door. And it worked. And I think now, without sounding like, an old bugger, people now often don't want to put that work in. When they arrive at a radio station, they expect to be put on the air straight away. And I think you have to learn the basics. And in a BBC local radio station in the early 90s, that was a brilliant place to learn the basics and try and give yourself a solid platform to move forward.
So when did things shift gears for you then, Nigel? When did you feel that perceptible move upwards?
Well, when I got my first job there, and they gave me a job when I did my degree, nothing to do with what I did with my degree. I've done absolutely nothing with my degree, and just basically parked that and then moved on. And I was working. I think I was on my first wage was, I think, 7.5-8 grand a year doing whatever I was doing. But I was a single lad in the early 90s, and it was great. And then I moved to Radio Lancashire, got a job. Guy Havord, who people may know, the sports reporter from Sky. He was the sports editor. He was a young guy at the time, in his mid-20s. I was, I think, 22 when I got the job there. And I went from 8 grand to 13 grand. And I thought I'd won the pools. You know, bought myself a car. And then all of a sudden, you feel as though you're doing a proper job then, in terms of sports reporting, because it was a busy patch. Blackburn were top of the Premier League. Burnley, Preston, Blackpool, all passionate football clubs with a passionate support, and you're in there straight away and you basically have to deal with it, and it was great.
Now, your mentor, Tom, as you mentioned in passing, was Tony Butler, who, as I mentioned, was the first phone-in host anywhere in the UK to actually take the bull by the horns and say Villa were rubbish today or Albion were rubbish. And must have been incredible to witness that at first hand, because as listeners across Birmingham, who's this guy who's you know, they had to introduce the 7-second delay
for him.
Tony Butler.
Yeah. He was an absolute genius for that radio thing. He hooked people. He was the first of his kind. But, you know, he was tough to deal with, because in those days, it wasn't commentary. It was everybody did reports into his show, which was music and sports news. And he had all these different people doing table tennis and God knows what else they were doing reports on. And you know, that was what he was. But he was tough. He had standards. If he said you get 20 seconds when you're at Blues or Villa and you went to 24 seconds, he just cut you off. And even during mid-report, he just cut you off. And I remember my first one, as I said to you, Stoke away, 0-0. First one, 1981. And I came back, I thought I did a good job. And I've gone to play the next day at Tally Ho for the BRMB football team, my first time. We're in the dressing room, all the people are there, George, Gavin, Ron, all the people are there. And I walk in a bit preen, a bit happy with myself, and Butler looks at me and he goes, if that's the best you can do, piss off back to the BBC. That was it. He nailed me. Now, I got upset, but I know what he was doing. did I say, right, I'll show you, or did I walk away and cry? It was a great move from him because he got me at it, and I wanted to prove to him I could be better than that.
Tough love is something we hear about an awful lot. I'm not quite sure, Nigel, that Guy Havard was quite that way with you, was he?
No, he wasn't. I mean, he was somebody who brought in a football phone in relatively early on at Radio Lancashire as well. And that was incredibly popular because, you know, Burnley fans, Preston fans, they would be at each other on the air all the time. But I think that what Tom says highlights a big difference at the time. You had independent local radio, which was quite brash, would always go for opinions, would give an opinion. And you had BBC local radio, which, of course, did the job and people were happy to listen to it. But it was a bit more pedestrian. You know, it was seen to be the Reithian values to educate and inform. And it wouldn't actually try and annoy people or wind them up. And I think that gradually, independent local radio and BBC local radio almost came closer together because of those big personalities in the regions. Of course, you had Tom and Tony Butler in the Midlands, Jonathan Pearce in London. You had guys like Mick Lowes up in the Northeast as well. And of course, Graham Courtney, our old friend who was working at Metro. I think that gradually people realised the way to do it was to engage with people and maybe wind people up because I'm sure on a Saturday night in Birmingham, people were going to the pub talking about what Tony Butler was talking about in the phone or George Gavin or what Tom was saying. Yeah. And I think before that time, no one did that. They listened to the football, they switched off, they might get the football pink in the evening and read that, that's and nice. That was it. But then I think radio really started to colour people's view of their football clubs. And I think it suddenly became a very important part of people's lives.
With Tony Butler, there was a transitional period where Tony left BRMB and Capital Gold. George Gavin became the sports editor and you were kind of his second in command.
Yeah.
And I know that your relationship, it was a little fractious, and I know you don't really speak much as two gents now.
No, we don't. I don't hide it. We don't speak. I don't like him. End of.
But he was good for you.
He was a brilliant operator. Let me, you know, personality aside, George Gavin was an absolutely amazing operator, wonderful in radio terms. And he and I did the Friday night phone-in. And you know when that chemistry works? It worked. Because we'd go in and out of breaks arguing and people thought, oh, that's just set. It was what it was, you know, because he was a bit leaning to Villa. The Blues fans knew I was one of them. So he created an amazing atmosphere on a Friday night. Compulsive listening, I thought, you know, even though I was part of it, I felt it was because I went home and I was buzzing even when I left the studio. And the fans thought that as well. We had amazing figures for a Friday night for the phone-in. But that relationship, you know, I got a lot to thank George Gavin for, a lot to thank him for, because he taught me a lot about the business. Because remember, I'd come in, I was 30 when I came into the business, you know, I wasn't young. I came in and did everything I can. I did any job they asked me. I go anywhere, any press conference, to do anything to get that road in. And it worked. And I got the chance and I was George's assistant and I loved every minute of it. It turned a bit not very nice at the end, but nevertheless, I got a lot to be grateful to George Gavin for.
And it's amazing as well, Tom. I used to go to university with my mate Chris, who's still my mate now, was a Villa fan. On a Friday night, his mum and dad had two ghetto blasters in the living room with two cassette tapes in. One recorded the BRMB phone-in, which was at 6 o'clock, I think.
Yeah.
The other one recorded the WM phone-in on the BBC at 6 o'clock, and it would be an hour, I think. And then he'd go up and watch Villa on a Saturday, and he'd spend 2 hours in the morning at home listening to the two phone-ins back-to-back to see what people were saying. So you clearly had an effect on people.
Well, it's Clive Tilsley, who we all know. Used to write a column in the Telegraph.
Yeah.
It was the Telegraph. And he said, when I'm driving through the Midlands, the BRMB phone in Friday night, compulsive listening. And from a man like Clive Tilsley, I took that as a real compliment.
Well, and he was the guy, he was my hero in terms of commentary, because I grew up in just outside Merseyside, listening to Radio City in the early 80s when Liverpool and Everton were two of the best clubs in Europe, and Clive was the guy doing the commentary every week. So if I've modelled my commentary style on anyone, I've tried to do it on him. I'm not sure I've ever been as good as him, but that's the sort of guy I looked to and thought, that's how I want to commentate.
And I think, Dance, you know, we talk about, I mean, you work with me, Dance. And I'm being honest, I wasn't the best of bosses because I wanted everybody to work, you know, 24/7. And sometimes I forgot that some of the staff had lives to lead. But I was that, you know, focused on being the number one in our own backyard that I sometimes forgot about other people, you know. So I apologise now, Dancy, if I was rude to you.
I've been doing the flying eye, the travel bulletins, because I came into the business at around about 30 years of age as well.
Yeah.
My first job was doing the travel reports after having done the comedy sketches for you, Tom.
Yeah.
But then Tom Nige used to have a whiteboard in his office, which was taped off into 14 different sections. And the next 2 weeks of fixtures were written up there with a marker pen. And there were initials assigned to who went where. So there was Mike Taylor, and there was, you know, Jim Proudfoot went with Tom somewhere, or Ian Crocker, who came before. There was Pete Moore. There were initials put to whoever's there. One day, I was just walking past the office, and the door was open. I looked in there, and against Walsall Chesterfield was ID. And I carried on walking past the office. It was about 5 minutes before. There's nobody else who works here with my initials. What's going on? So I walked in to see, you know, knocked on the door. Hello, Tom. Is that me up there? Yes, you said. You're going to Walsall. Go and see Phil the engineer. He'll give you a kit Friday night. You know, and that was it. That suddenly I realised I was being used as a reporter out of nowhere. It's a good job I checked. Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't have turned up and I'd have been in banging trouble.
To be fair, though, Dan, so, I mean, you were very similar to me in that you were that enthusiastic. You know, forget, I'm not about quality or ability. I'm on about your enthusiasm to be involved in sport and radio. You know, I love that. I don't care if somebody, I work with people who might not be quite as good, as long as they've got desire and passion, excitement, and they've got all those things, you know, they want to be good. I'll work with them. I can't stand people who are talented, but toss it off.
We'll get back to that in a little while, but I want to.
Are we on a 7 second delay?
I thought it's just podcast, isn't it?
I'll be furiously editing this later. Don't worry. I want to get back to you, Nige, because I want to know when things changed gears again and went from being somebody at BBC Radio Lancashire to somebody who gets a job on national BBC, which is presumably where the next move was.
Yeah, there was a sort of fairly clear pathway in the sort of like mid to late 90s that you worked in local radio if you showed the necessary application. And Tom's absolutely right, you've got to work hard and the necessary quality, maybe in inverted commas, extreme inverted commas in my case. You would try and go down to London, but it was very hard to get in at that stage because BBC local radio was quite strong. You look at the names, some of the names you've talked to on this podcast, and some of the names who were around at the time, there were lots and lots of people who went down to London to work for BBC Sport and became hugely successful. Mike Ingham, who was the football correspondent, started off at BBC Radio Derby. You've got Simon Brotherton. He was at WM, of course, on your patch. Steve Wilson came across from Capital Radio, and there were, you know, some fantastic commentators who went in. So I thought I was always going to struggle to try and get a job as a commentator because that was seen as the holy grail to become part of the football team at BBC Sport. So I went in as what they call the on the local radio desk. So basically I got a 3-month attachment and you would basically write the bulletins, what they call the rip and read, for every hour for the local radio stations, and you would cut the clips that would be sent out to the local radio stations for them to use in their bulletins. And again, that was a way in. And you keep knocking on the door of the football editor at the time and say, any chance of a game? And they would say, oh yeah, you've got to bide your time, blah, blah, blah. So you would bide your time. And at the time, I was still doing games for Radio Lancashire. If Preston were playing down at Watford or QPR, rather than them send somebody down, they'd get me to do it, you know, because it kept my hand in. And it was good to do it. And then eventually I got a commentary on the old, it wasn't Five Live Sports Extra then. It was, I think it was called Sports Choice or something. I don't even think it was broadcast because digital radio wasn't really a thing in the late 90s. And I did Coventry against Liverpool in the Premier League with David Boost, who was my co-com, because, of course, sadly, his career had come to a premature end. And I'm not sure anyone in the management listened to it. And then I basically got shunted off then to do breakfast television, to be the producer working overnights, doing their sports bulletins, which wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. And then eventually I got a job as doing the football news for Five Live, as they call a sports news correspondent. So I would basically be sent off to do FIFA and UEFA stuff in Switzerland, which was a fantastic job. But it also freed me up to maybe do football at weekends. So I'd do a 6-day week and I'd say to them, oh, if you want me to do a game on Saturday, I'm around. And eventually I got games on a regular basis. And then he moved on from there.
When you were editing, were you using reel-to-reel tape in those days, or have we moved on to computers by that point?
By the time I got to London, we'd moved on to computers, but it was still fairly clunky. When I was in local radio, well, I've still got the groove in my right shoulder now from carrying what's called a ewer around, which is a really heavy tape machine. And you had a reel-to-reel tape, and you would basically lace up the tape in the machine. You'd do the interview. You would pray that somebody hadn't left any leader tape in the middle of the tape, which would then basically render your interview useless. You'd go back to the office, you'd take the tape out, you'd stick it on a machine in the corner of the sports room. You'd get your thing called a China graph, a bit of chalk, and you'd get your razor blade, and you would cut the interview. And I remember one particular one, the day Alan Shearer was sold by Blackburn. Blackburn were not a fantastically open club to deal with. But I basically went down to Ewood Park and Rob called the chairman and said, yeah, we'll do the local radio. Took me up to his office, did the interview. And I didn't realise that the tape had snagged after about 10 seconds and the whole thing was lost. And we had to do the whole thing again. And that was, you know, your heart stops at that moment. But that was the technology. We complain about technology now, but it was, you know, it was like the dark ages, wasn't it? And I'm sure we all used it, you know, trying to get a Kubi line to work. And yeah. I'm sure Tom's job was to book all of those and try and get lines in and out of various radio stations. And it was incredible we ever got on the air.
It was then, though, in those days, we didn't do many commentaries, but look, we had Kubi points at the local grounds, but anything else, you had to book a phone with the local agency, book a phone. But it's interesting about the ewer, because that was my tool of my trade. And I had to learn editing with the block. And I've still got my block and my China graph, and I've got all that stuff still, just as a memento. But that taught me so much. But I remember going to cricket grounds like Worcester, and then to send the audio back to get it on before the programme ended, I got these two crocodile clips. I had to undo the phone in the red box and put these two crocodile clips, ask the operator before that to take the pips out, and then send this audio back. I mean, I'm sure it was highly illegal, but that's what you had to do to get the audio there. You know, you had to use different ways. Now you just interview somebody on your phone and send it. It's crazy.
That sounds quite similar to what Guy Mowbray did at Grimsby and caused what he thought was a floodlight failure that was entirely down to him.
I did cause a power cut once at Boston United. Their first game in the Football League, they were playing at York Street against Grimsby. And I was sitting there for Five Live on Sports on Five. And I don't know if you've ever been there. The press box is behind the goal, which is not great. And there was one plug there. And I had a thing called a scoop phone, which was a big blue box. And it was basically turned a phone line into a better quality line to report on. And there was this one socket plugged in, hit the switch, a flame licked out of it, almost took my hand off. And then basically all the power went in the whole stadium. And there was an opportunity that the game might have actually been postponed because they had no power. So they couldn't run anything. And, you know, it was very scary because they were looking at me saying, you're the man who was stopped our first game in the Football League. But thankfully, they managed to put 20 pence in the meter and the game took place.
That's not good for the soul, that, is it? A moment like that.
Not good for my hand either.
No. Well, at least your hand's still here to tell the tale. Yeah. After all that. Tom, in the podcast so far, we've talked an awful lot about sporting rights and exclusivity and how the BBC and commercial radio vied for audiences, particularly in the 1990s. And Sam Matterface on last week's show was talking about he once drew up a contract for Portsmouth when he was working down at the Quay. And he was talking about the exorbitant fees that some clubs charged for exclusivity or even just for a standard deal. You had five clubs on your patch to deal with, one of whom was one of the biggest clubs in the country, Aston Villa. You also had Albion Blues, Wolves and Walsall to deal with. But budget was always absolutely vital. How on earth did you keep the budgets down the way you did compared to other areas in the country?
Richard Park, because he was determined to get football off in this area. And we gave Villa a lot of money. I mean, we're talking $250,000 cash per season, plus contracts, plus, you know, plus stuff like a box or, you know, hospitality and stuff for games. We paid a lot of money to clubs.
What sort of bats on? What sort of era? Where are we talking?
90s, early 90s.
Okay.
But that was for exclusive rights. That was exclusive rights. The BBC hated it. And you know, and I'm such a competitive thing. I mean, all I wanted to do was to beat them. I know it's probably, but that's what drives me on, is to be number one, to be the best. And exclusive rights help that. Because remember, no, they didn't do commentaries until Richard Park started them in Birmingham. Then they realised they had to do them to catch up. That's how it happened. I mean, I get on with all the lads there. They're great operators. And I'm no longer as competitive because I'm not the head of sport in the Midlands anymore. So I'm all right with them. But at that time, you know, we had to pay a lot of money to get exclusive rights. And build that relationship with people, because forget the right signing a contract. You still need relationships, and people don't talk about it in the business anymore. I've built a career based on relationships with owners, managers, players. Them relationships are vital. I've had no life, Dance. You know, it's cost me marriages because I've been so absorbed in what I did. And that was the situation where I built my whole career based on relationships. It's a struggle to do that now because the advent of press offices, you can hardly get near anybody. You know, luckily, there's still one or two like Dean Smith, who I knew 20 years, 30 years ago, that make it easy for me. But relationships are the key, not just contracts, not just whether you're any good at what you do, but building a relationship with those people so they trust you and they will open up to you. Which is why, Dan, you were there. I used to get managers come on live at 2 o'clock. To give us team news, 2 o'clock, live, start the programme. Here's Barry Fry at Portsmouth, you know, and stuff like with the team news.
Or you would ring me if I was on my way to a game. Yeah. And you could ring me and say, I don't know where, who I was, well, West Brom or something. And
yeah,
say, Dance, this is the team, keep it to yourself. Yeah. Here it is. Sean Gregan's out. Somebody, you know, whatever, you know. And
so in that battle for that first hour, and if you get them twitching onto you, they won't turn away. To get them to turn on at 2 o'clock when your competitors are doing the same times, to get them to turn on, you have to have something different. Exclusive team news. So when they got to the grounds, the fans, the mates would say, oh, so-and-so, I heard that 2 o'clock on BRMB. That was gave us an edge. And then perhaps they would spread the word and perhaps the other listeners would, or the other fans would go, I must have a listen. And that's why we built up a massive audience with those relationships and people like yourself who were passionate about it and my other reporters. I mean, I even had guys who went to the BBC, Mark Regan. I had a big tall guy who went to Sky and ITV. I forget his name now.
Mark Bolton.
Mark Bolton. He did the Spanish football on Sky. These were great people that worked as hard as they could to get where they wanted to be. And we built those relationships. You had a great relationship with the Walsall manager, Ray, you might remember, you know, even though he gave you a rollicking on your first day, you know, these things count. I don't know whether Nigel agrees, but I don't think perhaps the BBC worry too much about relationships.
I think certainly at the time, in our patch in Lancashire, we had a problem with Blackburn because Blackburn were a club who had been a fairly moderate second division team. Suddenly all the money was pumped in with Jack Walker, and you had Kenny Dalglish there, and you had, you know, a team at the top of the Premier League. And you had Dalglish, who was not somebody who was helpful to parts of the media. And on the days I had to go down and interview him, the night before, I didn't sleep because I was worried about how it was going to go. and you get three questions, and that was it. And if he didn't want to talk to you, you got very little. And I think that I agree. I think particularly in the lower divisions, the relationships are very important. And I had a very good relationship with Gary Peters, the Preston manager. Yeah. He basically stayed there when John Beck left. And, you know, basically, I would ring him up on a Thursday afternoon and say, what time do you want me? I'll come at 8 o'clock. We'll have a cup of tea and have a chat, and then we'll do the interview. And I, you know, I had a very good relationship with him. Sam Allardyce was at Blackpool at the time. I had a very good working relationship with him. And David Moyes at Preston. And even now, when I see Moyesy at a West Ham game, he'd always come over and say hello. And he's just, you know, and I think it helps. And I think those relationships you build are very important. And I think in local radio, I think they're absolutely crucial. And I do think now we don't necessarily have the relationships at a national level. And I absolutely agree with you that the press officers now and the way that clubs are constructed make it very difficult because they're desperate to say they have an exclusive interview on their website. Basically, an interview with an employee. Well done. But that's what you're up against now. Club media see themselves as a competition to the local radio and the local papers. Whereas back in the day, people would tune into, you know, BRMB, or they'd get the back of the local paper to see what was going on at their football club. Now they go on to the website, but they're getting a different version of the truth, maybe, because they're getting what the club exactly want to tell you, rather than what, you know, Tom Ross has discovered by talking to people at Villa and actually maybe giving you the story which they want to hear. So it's a very difficult situation now. I don't envy people now coming into local radio to try and build the relationships that we had back in the 90s. Because if you were honest with people and if you were straight with people, I think then, you know, most football managers would appreciate that. And they knew if you looked after your locals, then you talk to your fans. Now that relationship has gone, I think, in many cases.
I think certainly it brings back so many memories of going to Bodymore Heath when John Gregory was the manager, or Brian Little or Ron Atkinson. And they go, I'm a bit busy. Go and have a bite to eat with the lads and I'll see you in a minute. You know, and you go and sit with the players and have a bite to eat in the canteen, and then you'd come back. And then I'd have to listen to John Gregory playing his guitar for half an hour before we actually did the interview. But all that was part of it. All that was part of it. And he earned the right. When Villa got to the League Cup final with Ron Atkinson, he allowed me to do my Friday night phone-in live from the team's hotel. I mean, would that happen now? Not a chance.
Well, he shouldn't have been there, Tom, because Tranmere were robbed in the semi-final, but that's another story.
I did that game as well, one of the best games I've ever seen.
That was the last great day of the standing halt end, wasn't it?
Of course, Tranmere, of course, when you mentioned him, I immediately thought Leyland Duff final, but that, I'll gloss over that. By the way, talking of commentary, Gary Newbon says he was, but I was the first man to broadcast live from the subs bench. I was on the subs bench at the Leyland Duff final with Tranmere and Birmingham, sitting next to the sub, Robert Hopkins, who moaned consistently about why he wasn't getting on. But I'm sitting there doing the commentary in a Birmingham City tracksuit. I'm on the team seat as the assistant trainer. Assistant physio. I'm on the team sheet with my headphones in a bucket. Crazy days. Wouldn't happen now, but all part of the fabric of what is a wonderful industry.
You talked, obviously, as the head of sport, you had to forge relationships, as you mentioned, Tom, with owners, with managers, with players. But with what Nigel was just saying about, you know, the sanitized version of interviews that you get now sometimes on club websites, how compromised were you at times, or weren't you? You can tell me I'm completely wrong in this, in terms of wanting to criticise a manager for what he's doing, but knowing, hang on, I've got a sports forum with him in 2 weeks' time that we're doing live, or, you know, we've got negotiations coming up to continue our exclusivity deal. Was that a compromise you had to bridge?
Never. And I'll tell you why. Because I would always tell the truth. But what I wouldn't do is sensationalise anything. I'd tell the truth, but the first thing, if I got a story that was negative about Villa or about Blues or about West Brom or Wolves or Walsall, first thing I did was ring the club for a reply. Give the club a chance to put their side. Today, in the modern game, they run the story and then ask the club the day after for what's the situation. I ain't like that. I'd say, this is what I've heard. And I mean, listen, I fell out with David Sullivan, for goodness sake, who I'd spent, you know, I'd had a weekend at his home with Terry Cooper and stuff, and all sorts. I still fell out with him because I told him straight what I thought about a certain situation. The trading standards, you may remember, that time. So I told him straight, you know, I fell out with people at West Brom. I fell out with Villa. Doug Ellis and I had battles galore. But he respected me and I respected him because he knew everything I said to him I believed and was the truth. And then he would argue the case and put his point of view. And that's the way we left it. But I think, you know, compromised is totally the wrong. The fans will say, yeah, you were compromised because I didn't agree with them. But if you know, because you've been in it and Nige, you go into clubs and you're told things off the record. So you can't actually say it, but you say something to fans and they go, well, how do you know? And I say, well, just I do. And then they don't believe, but you know what I'm saying? So sometimes it's a very difficult business to be in when you're close to a club and you get the stories and you get the information and sometimes the fan don't know. I mean, it causes you problems. I remember under Alex McLeish, he rang me and said, we've signed the guy who went to Villa. Oh, my goodness. Wore weird suits and a fedora hat. Recently times, anyway. He said, I've signed this player. You can use it. So I went, okay. So I put it out. And overnight, the agent asked for more money and the deal fell through. I got personally abused the day after. But I couldn't say the manager had told me to because he said, don't say it come from me. Do you see where I'm coming from? But I got the abuse, but didn't break his trust. And when you don't break their trust, they'll stay with you.
And I think that's absolutely crucial. I remember a time when I was at Radio Lancashire covering Preston, and I'd gone to interview Gary Peters one afternoon before a game, and this little red, I think, mini Metro turned up outside the old offices at Deepdale, and this young lad, spotty individual, came up the steps, banged on the door, and there was nobody else there because the secretary had gone off for their lunch and I was sat there, and I had to open the door for him. And this lad went, hello, I'm David Beckham and I've come for a medical. And he was going to sign on loan for Manchester United. And then Gary Peters came out of his office and went and saw me there and then saw David Beckham there and then basically ushered David Beckham down the tunnel for him to have his medical. And he said to me, look, if you use this now, then that's it. And well, I didn't use those words. I held on to it. I mean, I could have gone straight on the radio and said, David Beckham is signing for Preston North End on loan. But I didn't. And he gave it me first the following day.
There you go.
And that's how it works. And I think those, you have to have that trust. And there are, you know, some very good journalists around now. That's not, you know, people who cover the big clubs, like, say, John Cross at the Mirror at Arsenal. You know, there are people who have trusted contacts within those clubs and use them responsibly. And I think that back in the day, before social media, there was a smaller circle around football clubs in terms of the media. And I think it made it easier to have good relationships with those managers and with those players. And I think it's sad that it's gone in many ways, because you could speak to a player and they wouldn't give you the team news, but they give you a general view. Now, yeah, if you try to speak to a player, you'll get a press officer on the phone banning you.
It's interesting, Dan, that, because, you know, I remember I'd gone to interview Ken Weldon at Birmingham. And he said, I'm with the secretary. Can you show this player that we might be signing around? I went, yeah, of course. I mean, me. I was a reporter from BRNB, showing around the ground. It was Gary Mabbott. He'd come from Bristol Rovers. And I was showing him, he never signed for Birmingham in the end, but I was showing him around the ground. Gary Mabbott, for goodness sake. What a miss that was by the club.
But
I showed him around the ground, but was told not to mention it. You know, I mean, these are bizarre things. I had a call, right? The call came from the manager, right, Dave Mackay. He said, get yourself in, boy. We're selling players to Everton. Wayne Clark. I went, yeah, I'm in. So I went in, went up to his office, and there was Howard Kendall. I knew Howard from Birmingham. So, Howard, how are you? Everything good? And he said, right. He said, we've just paid £400,000 for Wayne Clark and Stuart Storer. I went, oh. He said, £350,000 for Stuart Storer, who, by the way, was a reserve who'd never played a game, and £50,000 for Wayne Clark, who had got 20 goals that season. And I went, that can't be right. And Ken Weldon, I think it was Ken Weldon, I'm sure it was the chairman, apparently Wolves had got 50% of the sell-on price for Wayne Clark. So we sold a reserve to, I mean, he played a few games, but not much. And he ended up maybe a Bolton, I think, Stuart Storer. But like, I'm thinking, I can't believe what I'm hearing. But that's the trust they have when you've got a good relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it takes time to forge relationships. Sometimes it can be very quick. I do like to recount a story with you, Tom, where I think I was working on the sports desk at BRNB one day, and the news was confirmed that we'd heard rumoured and you'd had a tip-off that Gary Megson was to be the new West Bromwich Albion manager. So this is late 90s, early 2000s. So I turned around to you. You're sitting at your desk typing away, and I said, Tom, it's confirmed Megson's the new Albion manager. And you went, oh. And you went, he is a miserable bugger, by the way.
I know.
Within 2 weeks, you're at 10-pin bowling with him.
He's my pal. He still is. We have some great times. But, and there's one. Every Albion game I did, come in the office with him and have a sandwich before the game, and I'll give you the team news. And we back. Listen, it was all it was swapping banter and stories, because I think if you've got that relationship, we can have a laugh with people. And Gary Megson is as funny as they come. I promise you. People don't like him. I thought he was amazing. And he became a really good friend and still is. I did my own podcast with him recently. He was hilarious. I mean, I remember the day when a national radio station put out that Gary Megson had been killed riding his bike. And my news rang me, my news department rang me and said, Gary Megson's been killed. I went, is he? So I rang him up and I went, you're supposed to be dead. And he's gone, no, I'm not. I said, you're supposed to be. It's been on the national radio. And he went, no, apparently it was Gary Mason, the boxer, which was sad enough. But my point is, that's the power of radio, you know?
That was the power of Alan Brazil's thick Scottish accent, slightly getting his pronunciation off when it came to the surname.
But that relationship meant I could ring him. That relationship meant I could just ring him and say, is this right? Is this what's happening? You know, and it's happened before. I remember I rang David Sullivan because somebody said he ain't very well. So I rang him up, you know, he said, I'll call you back. And he called me back. He said, look, I've had a heart problem. I'm going into hospital. I have stents fitting. Front page of the Birmingham Mail, and because it was on BRNB, he gave me the story. Front page of the national newspapers, not the front page, but the local newspapers front page, but big story in the press. Because I had that relationship with people. It happened everywhere with Walsall. It happened with West Brom, with Megson. It happened with Brian Little, was the manager of West Brom. You know, and I remember telling him, what you just told me will get you the sack. He'd gone the next morning. You know, and that was in an interview with us where he criticised the board and stuff. So them relationships get you where you want to be. You can't do it today. I remember quite recently, Emil Heskey at Aston Villa. I walked into Bodymore Heath for the press conference. He sees me on the bus, jumps off it. Rossi, what's happening at Blues? The press officer, Brian Dugan, then ran 40 yards. What are you talking about? I said, Brian, I said, I'm saying hello. It's a quaint old English custom. I'm saying hello to somebody. But they panic now. If you speak to people, as Nigel said, that's the saddest part of our business today.
I mean, I worked with Gary Megson as well. He was Blackpool manager for a year. And you're absolutely right. He had quite an abrasive persona, I think. And a lot of the fans didn't like him. He actually replaced Sam Allardyce. And it was a difficult time at the club as well, because Owen Oyston had been the chairman and he had to go elsewhere, as people can find out if they want to look. And but Gary Megson off the microphone was one of the funniest people I've ever spoken to. And when he got the Albion job, and I was at Five Live, I went to interview him an hour and a half before a game. They sent me on a Saturday to speak to him. And by then we graduated from the Euros onto a mini disc.
Yeah,
and we're doing the interview on a mini disc, and we do the interview, and it's fine. And he remembered me from Blackpool and having a chat. And then he goes, oh, I need to buy one of those mini discs. And one of his kids wanted one. So an hour before a game, a big game for Albion, I'm basically discussing mini discs with him and how he can sort a mini disc player. And he was just, I think he was a real man of contradictions. I don't know whether he felt he had to be abrasive And that was the way he would get by as a manager. Because you remember, he was an excellent footballer. He was a very, very good midfielder, really good player, possibly underrated at the highest level. But I think that if he maybe given a bit more of himself when he was a manager, maybe he would have had a more successful career. I know he's loved at Albion, and when he went back as a caretaker a couple of years ago, people were really happy to see him. But I think he almost had this quite bruising image as a manager, but it wasn't really him, was it?
I got a call from Jeremy Peace, who was a director at West Brom. He said, look, I believe the board, I think it was, I forget who the owner was then at Sanderson's, but anyway, they want to get rid of Gary Mixon. He said, I want to take over the club. I want a coup. I want to get rid of them and keep Gary. Now, this is him sitting down in the radio cafe underneath BRMB on Broad Street. And I said, look, I said, you know, if I can help, I'll help. I'll put out your story, you know. And he said, I said, but if it goes wrong, I'm the one that's going to be in the trouble at West Brom. But he won it. Gary stayed. Jeremy Peace took over. But then Gary actually fell out with Jeremy Peace, I believe, in the end. And I think that's been the problem for Gary not getting a job, is that I think a lot of people think his hard work or he's going to be disruptive. He's going to be a problem for directors because of what was said about him after leaving West Brom. Because he's a good manager. He knows what he's doing and he can make things happen. But sadly, we're in that sort of industry. You can't get a job for love nor money.
Gary was a guy I interviewed after one of the most dramatic games I ever commentated on for Capital Gold Birmingham when they were 3-0 down at West Ham and came back to win 4-3.
I remember that.
Lee Hughes scored a very late winner. I was there with Bomber Brown. We went down to the tunnel at Upton Park. And there's a state of euphoria around the West Brom staff and the kit men and everyone walking around the corridors and the subs. They're just elated. They've come back from 3-0 down. They're on their way to promotion. It's an amazing day. Gary comes out of the changing room to talk to me. And I think my first question was something like, well, Gary, where do we start with that? And he immediately, like that, is answered, well, let's start with our defending in the first half, which was absolutely criminal. And he bangs on about how bad they've been in the first 15 minutes rather than the elation of a last-minute winner. That's Gary Megson. But anyway, look, Nigel, I want to talk to you about the differences, if there are any, because as I mentioned in the introduction, you're one of the rare guys who've commentated for both BBC Five Live and for TalkSport, of course, where you are now working with me. What differences, if any, are there between working for the national broadcaster and, you know, the biggest independent national broadcaster?
I think there are plenty of differences. I feel working with TalkSport, there are more opportunities. When I was at Five Live at the time, you got to a point where you felt you were banging your head on a glass ceiling because you had the top two commentators, Mike Ingham and Alan Green, and they were basically cemented there for years and they weren't going anywhere. And there wasn't really any opportunity to go any further. And as I said before, it was seen to be the holy grail to become a member of the football team. But once you were there, yeah, it was great. And you only commentated on football and you do the odd interview day and what have you. But it was quite a difficult position because a lot of people elsewhere in the department resented the fact that people had those sort of jobs. And when you were there, you basically reached a point where you were never actually going to do the biggest games because it didn't really matter how well other people commentated. It was basically, that was it. You know, we knew at the start of the season who was going to commentate on the cup finals and, you know, playoff finals and everything else, because that's how it always was. Whereas I think at TalkSport, you know, there are more opportunities. Maybe there are fewer commentators, or certainly there were when I moved over there. And I think if you do a good job, you know, it moves you on.
When and why did you make the switch?
Well, the decision was made for me because at the time, Five Live used to have two commentators, of course. They would have, you know, two commentators doing a half or a quarter of a half, and they decided to cut that, and they felt they had to basically let a number of commentators go, and I was ready to leave anyway, to be honest, because I'd reached the point where I thought I wasn't really progressing and maybe I'd gone a bit stale, and it was a good time to leave because the London Olympics were happening, and I commentated on that, did water polo for TV at the London Olympics, which was something which I'd never done before, but it was a great thing to do. And it was a great way to go out. And I did 19 years at the BBC, learned an incredible amount, very important part of my life. But it was the right time to go. And I think looking back, I think it was a good time to leave Five Live as well, because it's reached a point now where it's, I think they're struggling financially to a certain extent. And it's great being on TalkSport because we're taking the rights that they used to have. And I suppose I've been a beneficiary of that. But as Tom said, Sports Report used to be the thing you listened to at 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And I think that the way that the media's become more dispersed, I think that while BBC Radio still has some terrific people working and still does some terrific work, I think that possibly it's now part of the market, whereas before it used to be the market.
You mentioned there, I mean, one of the names you mentioned there, I thought did commentary disservice. How can you sit at a football match and say, this is rubbish, what am I doing here? Your job is to engage the listener. Not to tell him it's good if it's bad, but to engage the listener, not to encourage him to switch off. Your job is to engage the listener. Now, even if it's not the best of games, you can still find something. Can they hang on to the point? Can they get themselves back into this? You can find something to grab the listener and keep him with you for the journey to the final whistle. That's as I see it. It's too often, commentators, you know, let themselves run away with themselves. They forget who they're broadcasting to. The listener's the key here. Keeping him engaged with you is absolutely vital. Don't give him a reason to switch off, for goodness sake. Don't give him that option to turn the off button. You know, and you know, that's the difference, I think, between the BBC and independent radio, as was then. Now, I know people say it's easier at local radio because you can be biased. You can't tell lies, even if you're biased and you want your team to win. You've got to call the game as you see it. But there are reasons and ways you can engage the listener and make sure that he's... If you're not excited, if you're not passionate, if you're not all those things, how can you expect the blooming listener to be? That's how... Dan Sutty's heard all this before. That's how I am with all my commentators. You know, be excited. You know, tell them where the ball is. You know, I hate commentators who say, kicking left to right. That only applies depending on where you're sitting in the ground. If you're sitting the other side of the ground, that doesn't apply. So when you've got a listener, you've got to remember where he is and what he's blind. Talk him through, paint the pictures and sell the game to keep him with you. You know, Dansel has grown immensely from what he was when he first joined to now to being a very accomplished commentator. But countdown the clock, all them sort of things that independent radio have done in the past. I'm sorry, I think there are some commentators who start to believe in their own hype rather than what's best for the listener, in my opinion.
It's certainly, there's one or two examples like that. I can think of a commentator who walked into a cup final. I'm not even sure what I was doing. I think I might have just been doing reports. It certainly wasn't a commentary that I was doing. And a certain commentator walked into the press room at Wembley and exclaimed, "I don't know what I'm doing here." I think it was the Portsmouth FA Cup final.
Was it an Irish accent by chance?
I can't remember offhand, Tom, to be fair, but there was an air of, this game's beneath me. And that concerned me when I saw that, because I thought, well...
You wouldn't have lasted long with me with that attitude if you'd have been you, Dan.
Well, I'm sure, Nigel, you have people who told you things when you were in your early stages, and those little building blocks stay in your head. When I think of Tom saying, "Alan's gone, where's the ball? When there's a corner, which two stands is it between? What's the score?" Keep telling him the score. These little things stay in your head. Every single commentary you do, and if you let them slip out your head, you're in trouble.
I was going to say, you'd know as well as anybody, Nigel, that nobody listens. Some commentators think that they've turned in to listen to them. They're not. They've turned in to hear the game, irrespective of who's commentating. So if you're commentating, your responsibility to keep them informed. They don't listen all the time. They're basically, they'll get in the car. Most radio listening's done in the car. They'll get in the car. They'll get out the car. When they get back in the car, they want to know what the score is. So keep telling them the score, as I told you, Dan. That's the reason. And keep informing people where the ball is. Attacking the cop. Attacking the halt end. A left wing corner. People then know what you... They paint their picture because they're blind. So they get a picture of the game in their mind and they're on the journey with you. It's simple, really.
We are never the story, and that's one thing you have to remember. We are the people who are telling the story.
Correct.
For the listeners at home or the viewers, if you're doing television. But it's not about us. And I saw a piece that Peter Drury did for a university recently, and he was talking about the importance of engagement. And he said, you can do Burnley nil, Crystal Palace nil. And, you know, it can be a terrible game. But for somebody watching or listening, it's the highlight of their week. They've waited all week to watch this game. And you've got to recognise that. You can say it's a poor game, but you can't basically be full of opinion about why Sean Dyche should be doing something Correct. Differently. Because ultimately, that's not our job. You've got a former player who can tell you why Sean Dyche isn't doing things right. But I always think our job, commentators commentate and pundits pontificate. Well, and that's what I've always tried to think.
He'll tell you that. I used to say to them, you tell them what's happened, let the pundit tell it why. Now, I had occasions, a couple of occasions, where the commentator would say, well, that's a X, Y, Z. And the pundit would say, no, you're wrong, actually, and made him look an idiot. Now, I think if you keep to, I'll tell them what's happened, you tell them why, that'll end all the problems you'll face.
Yeah, and I do quite a lot of commentary on women's football because it's clearly a lot more of that now. And yes. I often work with a lot of women players who've come out of the game relatively recently, haven't done too much punditry. And I just say to them, yeah, just tell me what I can't see. And just, you know, and if you're a defender, tell us why it's difficult to defend against Vivian Miedema. Or if you're a striker, tell us, you know, why it's difficult to try and go beyond a certain player. And you've got to basically make it as relevant for the listener as you can. Absolutely. And I think that the issue of relevance is something that we've always got to bear in mind. We need the nuts and bolts, and Tom's absolutely right. You know, what's the score? How long's gone? But you've got to give the listener a reason to keep listening. And I think that if you're basically just saying it's rubbish and giving your opinion, these days, with so many other opinions readily available on your phone or everywhere else, people will just switch off.
It's the same in boxing. I do boxing commentary for BeIN Sports. And one of the things I've got a three times world champion sitting next to me. Am I going to argue with him about? No, he's been in the arena. He's been in the ring. And I think when they've had that experience, like former players, listen, they're not always right, but their opinion's more valid than anybody else's.
Sometimes you can ask the question of a pundit, but you can frame it in such a way that you Correct. Want knowledge rather than you sort of forcing a point on them. Listen, we're running very short of time, gents, and I just want to wrap up with a couple of final things. Tom, I know one of the things that Capital Gold and BR&B Sport pioneered was the Sports Forum, which was a very important part of what you did as sports editor, where the fans got to meet the managers mostly, although there were player forums as well. But sometimes it got very, very poisonous. You talked about the Albion takeover earlier. And one of my most terrifying, but there was Tony Hale, who was the former West Bromwich Albion chairman, did a sports forum at the Throstles Club just opposite the Hawthorns. I was there with the gun mic to take questions from the floor. You were the host. And you recorded it as live. It was recorded for a straight hour. And it went out as live. It was unbelievable that the vitriol that was thrown at him for an hour. And you realise then, you know, the passion of football fans and this stoic man who wasn't a nasty man, Tony Hale. But
you're spot on, Dance. We had a few of them. Dave McKay got it in the neck as well. The first question to him from the floor was, why don't you go away? Not in those polite terms. But you're absolutely right. But they were great. We had managers, we had owners. When I did David Sullivan and Karen Brady at the Austin Sports and Social Club, 700 people rammed in it. They turned away 3,000 applications for tickets. So that was the power of those forums. But they were absolutely brilliant. I was the gun mic before I started doing it, like yourself was. And I remember Bobby Gould, after two defeats, didn't turn up. So we carried on with the forum with an empty chair. And questions coming to George Gavin. It was like hilarious. The fans reckon we got more sense out of the empty chair, to be honest. But those were the sort of things that happened. And I'm glad you're mentioning that those forums were legendary. We did all sorts of sports. Just the football ones were amazing, though. But, you know, you get, as a commentator, you will find experience. Like, I don't know whether you've had it yet, Dance, where fans get involved. and start swearing down your microphone. I had it at Charlton. You know that long thing at Charlton, the long press box? Well, I'm sitting with Bomber Brown and Albion are three up at Charlton. Alan Kirbishley was the manager. And this guy's leaning over, why don't you Brummy XYZ, Brummy bleep, 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 Brummy bleep. My producer said, if you don't stop him, we're going to pull the plug. I've took, in mid-commentary, I've took the headphones off. I've stood up, turned around, ready to lace into this guy. He's 8 foot Neanderthal with earrings and a broken nose. And I've gone, I'm in trouble here. I've looked at him and I've gone, I thought in for a penny. I've gone, you're an absolute disgrace. What? And while I'm lambasting this guy, a voice from my left goes, you're on your own. My hero, Bomber Brown. My hero puts his head and feet where nobody fears the tread. You're on your own. I mean, but those are the sort of the things that a commentator. And of course, I'm sure you'll mention it, Dan, Jay Bothroyd at Wolves, the commentator's curse. I mean, you obviously, you know the story, but he's coming on. I'd done a forum the week before with the manager, Mick McCarthy. And Mick McCarthy, he said, I wish he'd get in the box more. That's why I don't pick him, da-di-da. Anyway, so he's getting ready to come on. And I've gone, well, that's good news for Albion because he's useless. Wrong opinion. But nevertheless, that's what I said. His first touch, he scores. His first touch, he scores. And Bomber had already said, you shouldn't have said that because he could haunt us. I couldn't believe it. ITV, is it Matt Hancock? Matt Hancock, is it? The guy, the comedian type fella who did the Central Smith.
Nick Hancock.
Yeah. He did that. He ran a piece on it. And I learned a valuable lesson, and every commentator should, and Nigel's already mentioned it. Don't give your opinion. Don't give your opinion. Don't say things. I let myself down then massively, but I learned a lot from it. You know, it was a tough time for me. I spoke to him afterwards, eventually, Jay Bothroyd, and apologised. But, yeah, for any commentator, keep your opinions to yourself.
Nigel, just finally with you, you do keep yourself very busy because I know you do stuff for TalkSport with me. I think you're at Wolves on Saturday, for example, to do the game against Newcastle. But you also have this occasional thing in your diary where you get to do two games a day because you do an awful lot of work for what's known as the World Feed, which tends to be a commentary that's done from off a telly somewhere in West London. But you're sometimes able to straddle that alongside with doing a live commentary at Grand somewhere the same day.
Yeah, I do that quite a lot, you know, double bubble, because we're all freelance and we all have to make the money, I think, when we can. And yeah, I mean, I've had some fairly tight ones where you've worked for two different companies in different parts of London and you do one game and then there'll be a lot of injury time and you'll jump in the car and have to try and get somewhere else. And yeah, it's just something that we do. And I spoke to one of our colleagues from the BBC recently who doesn't have to do that. And he said, I just can't believe you do that. I just can't believe that you're able to concentrate on one game whilst doing the other one. But it's just the way it is. It's a way of life now. And I'm doing it this Sunday. I'm covering women's football. I'm doing a French women's game at 11:45. And I'm doing Blues, actually. In the WSL, they're playing Manchester United at 6:45. So I'll do one game, pop out, have a spot of lunch. My wife's working, so I'll meet her, have a spot of lunch, and then go back and do the other one. But yeah, they can be quite long days. But you know, look, it's football commentary at the end of the day. We are not going down a pit. We're not working on an ICU ward. We're doing something that thousands of people would love to do every single Saturday and would probably be very envious of us. So, you know, more is more in this case.
And just finally, if I can, just listening there to Nige talking, I remember doing an early kickoff at a game and rushing back to the studio to do the phone-in, but the motorway was blocked. So I pulled off at the services and did the phone-in from the service station.
I remember it
spoke
well.
Spoke to the manager. He said, come into the office, plugged in whatever it was I had to plug in and did the phone-in. But, you know, Nigel's spot on and you know, Dan's. Confucius said, find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I've been that lucky.
I can't believe you thought you could get back from Everton to Birmingham in 2 hours from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock to host a phone-in. Whoever told you that? I mean, I know you drive fast, but you're not that quick.
Good point, well made. I think Man United were at home, so everybody was heading back to where they come from.
That old an age-old problem of the M6. I've got a pathological fear of that motorway heading north or south.
Particularly, that's something I don't miss is the away games.
There you go. Listen, Tom, Nigel, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining me for this little chat. It's been really enlightening. Nigel, good luck at Molyneux on Saturday. You're working with Perry Groves, and you'll bring the jelly babies, I can guarantee you that, if nothing else.
Cheers, Dad. I hope you'll bring some goals. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, it could be a bit eggy, couldn't it, the way that they've played so far this season. Tom, you're about to go off and do a few press conferences.
I'm going to see Val Ishmael ahead of Albion's game, which is TalkSport's Friday night game anyway, so I'm going to do him. And then I shall be at Blues against Forest on Saturday.
There you go. You see, we're always busy. There's always something going on in a commentator's world, this weird world where no 2 weeks are ever the same. Tom, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And Nigel, thank you as well, fella. Thanks for coming on.
Cheers
guys. Great to chat. Cheers, Tom. See you soon, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Nigel Adley and Tom Ross, my guests on the Commentator's Curse. There'll be another one along next week with two more guests of mine from this strange old world of commentary that we inhabit. But you can check out the archive in the meantime of all the previous episodes. My thanks to Tom and Nigel. Ian Dancer signing off. You've been listening to The Commentator's Curse.